Webby is not a package manager. Upgrading things is not a concern.
Today, I am joined by AJ O'Neill. So AJ and I have been friends for going on almost a couple of years now. We're both local here in Utah. Actually met AJ at a Rust meetup, but that is not what we're here to talk about today. We're here to talk about Webby or webinstall.dev. But before we do that, AJ, can you take just a little, just a couple seconds and give us a little bit of your background. Who are you? What are the kinds of projects you're working on these days?
I'm a college dropout that has worked for a variety of startups, and Node and Go have been my ticket to fame and fortune.
I was surprised to learn that because, like I said, we originally both met at a Rust meetup. And I only later found
I'm
out
reformed.
That you're...
I've repented.
Yeah, you're no not actually a Rust developer. it turns out you actually like Go, as I do, but that you mostly write Node. And you say you're a reformed Rustation. What does that mean? Why are you no longer writing Rust?
Because, well, one, it takes quite an investment. And I don't have... I do have a lot of time to do work on projects, but the projects that I don't know. But when I went to the meetup and I learned that they had implemented operator overloading, that was when I fell out of love.
Hmm.
That was when, you know, it went from, and I still believe that there's good in Rust and I still believe that there's, you know, a path forward, but that was the moment where it's like, you know, this is like, these are not my people. This is not my thing.
One feature too many.
And a particularly bad one at that. Operator overloading. Who has something nice to say about operator overloading?
Yeah. A lot of Java developers, I think. Right? Like a
Who
lot
has
of people
something nice to say
with...
about a lot of Java developers.
Is it even Java? I don't even... Java supports operator overloading, right? I'm not making that up.
I don't know. C++ does.
C++
and
for
I think
sure.
That they're trying to pander to C++ devs. Or okay. I don't know. I shouldn't say because I don't know. But anyway, let's leave that in the dust. Zig. Zig is the future. Zig is all of the... It's like the best parts of Go and Rust combined and the worst parts left behind. So I'm looking forward to Zig. And Zig is something where... I already have a personal project I'm working on it, and I spent a few hours with someone who actually knows Zig, and I was able to be productive for the rest of the day. So
okay, that's pretty cool. We're going to do another episode probably next year on Zig once you've had a little more time to play with it, and once I have had literally any time to play with it. I've like watched the talks and read a little bit here and there, but certainly not enough to actually record a podcast episode about it. So we'll look forward to that one. Cool. So today I want to talk about Webby. Webby is a fantastic tool that all of my students on Boot Dev become familiar with very quickly in the curriculum because we use it to install some of the developer tooling the students need to get up and running. I think I'm trying to remember, but I think the first thing I have them install with it is PyEnv so they can then manage their Python installations. Let's just start there. Why did you break ground on this project? Why does the world need a Webby?
Okay, there's two different questions there, and they have different answers. So for me, it really started as a shell script to install Node from GitHub releases because of the sudo npm problem, which now is not a problem, but for a long time was. So when you install Node from the PKG on macOS, it has an unfortunate side effect that it will re-permission /user/local. And you have to manually take a step to re-permission it again before it will work correctly. And then if you install Go, then Go will also change the permissions of user local. And so then you have to fix it again. And if you install via Brew, I mean, I really was starry-eyed about teaching people to code and getting people involved with code. And when step one is, okay, so now we're going to wait on your Comcast internet connection for the next 15 minutes for Brew to install.
Brew takes so long to install. It's unreal. Yeah.
Yeah. And so that was kind of the impetus, where the permission problems and then the long time of Brew. And then also, if you've used Brew for a long time, but you're not like a person who loves Brew, if you just use it when you need to use it, you have definitely come across the case where stuff starts breaking, and like weird stuff starts breaking, like SSH, curl, like things that you need to get your work done, because you go to install something and then Brew updates something. And the problem is that Brew has its stuff in system paths. Now, they're it's not overwriting the system version of curl or the system version of libssh, but it is putting those things in a path where the system will get confused about it.
I just run Brew Doctor and send it up with a prayer, and that works actually never. So actually, I don't recommend it.
Well, you can Webby Brew, and I'm not joking. If you Webby Brew, it follows the instructions that are in their alternative installation methods, and it will put it in a conflict-free path where you won't have that set of problems. But that's a different issue. But anyway, so it kind of started with, I just want a way to install Node quickly that's the correct version, that's the latest version. Because then also, if you do apt, a lot of people don't get that. I mean, especially when you're new, you don't understand the nuance here. Apt is not for installing developer tools. Apt is for installing system tools. The reason that apt has a version of Node that's 6 years old is because there's some other tool that you can apt install that is being installed from the perspective of a user. A user wants to do a thing. There's an application that requires Node. It's pinned to this old version of Node. And so the reason that Node's in there is not so that you can sudo apt install Node and then work with Node. The reason Node's in there is because Node is a dependency of something else that a user might reasonably want. And they're pinning to that version of Node, because in the tool chain of dependencies and, you know, everything, that version of Node is known to work with those applications that depend on it, and they build their packaging around that version. So
I had no idea that that was the case. I've been a developer for, you know, 7-8 years and never knew that apt was a system. I mean, so is it like they build for sysadmins or something, like, rather than developers? Is that kind of the philosophy?
Yeah. Well, no, it's a Linux admin tool. So the idea is that you're going to deploy something and you want hardened versions. And you also with apt, oftentimes you're getting custom patches. So the app people haven't had time to review libssl 2.7q. So instead they're going to ship libssl 2.7, M dash, yeah, you know, 1+ Ubuntu patch fix 5.7, you know, so you're getting weird versions of things. And the reason for that is because it's more, you know, it's kind of the pre-cloud days type of mentality. You're deploying a mail server, you're deploying a file server, you're deploying some sort of appliance. And so when you look at RPM and apt, they're absolutely not for developers. They're absolutely for sysadmins. And it is about developing a desktop experience, if that's the distro it is, or the server experience is kind of the more traditional use case.
That makes a lot of sense. I've never thought about it from that perspective, but I have noticed things like, for example, I use Hugo to run my blog, and installing Hugo through apt was like a crazy number of versions behind. Like the latest on apt was like 40 minor versions. I think they're still on zero. I think Hugo's still like 0.111 or something, but they're like 40 minor versions behind. And so I had to install like from source or something. I can't remember what I did.
It's enterprise. They are guaranteeing some level of support for those versions too, right? You know, whether it's Ubuntu or it's Red Hat or whatever it is, there's an enterprise license. So they have, there's a whole life cycle there. So it's just, it's not intended for the developer use case. That's not what it's for. And so, but you know, you learn about Linux and you learn about apt, and you're like, oh, I can apt install Node, and then nothing works. And so anyway, that was the impetus, was I want people to be able to install Node. And originally it was just there was this Node project that I had that was just a shell script, and you know, that was the impetus for Webby. And then it grew because then I worked at a company where they had the Docker problem. The Docker problem being, we can't ship your machine to the customer. No one knows how to reproduce this setup, but we can ship a Docker image that no one understands how it got there, and everyone's afraid to touch it. No one wants to modify a single line of anything in that repository because it'll break.
Right.
But you can ship it to the customer. And so with that, in order to do development on your local system, it was like, okay, so you need this whole Docker Compose setup. And it's like, look, I'm a Go developer. I need to test an API. I should not have to install an entire ecosystem of services just to get the database at the right version to be able to test my component that I'm working on. So I started building out some tooling that kind of extended from what I'd done with Node, and I actually started rewriting it in Go. But anyway, those two projects were what Webby was before it was Webby. And then, when I started working with, Ryan Burnett, who's a buddy of mine of many years, we met through a work project. I don't remember exactly how the conversation went, but he was the one that pushed it into the public sphere because he has the front end skills. And I think he really liked what, you know, I had done with the Node script, and he had used it a few times. And then the other thing I was telling him about, he's like, you know, we got to get this thing together and get it out there for people. And so it kind of became a weekend project, the first version of it. And it's grown for a few years from there.
It's really cool. What's this whole deal? So as I'm researching Webby the first time, you told me about it kind of offhandedly after one of the meetups that we'd gone to. You're like, you should check out this thing, might be good for your students. And I was like, yeah, sure, I'll check it out when I have some time. And then I check it out. I'm like, oh, actually, this solves like a lot of the problems that a lot of my new students are having getting tooling installed. One of the problems, as you mentioned, is like permissions. So it's like, okay, I'm going to brew install something, but occasionally I have to sudo brew install that thing. What's your philosophy surrounding the whole permissions problem, and why does Webby take the approach that it does?
Okay, so when you sudo, so there's historical reasons, and some of that is FUD. You know, there's a lot of the hand wavy, you know, it's dogma, it's religion. I don't sudo because my sensei told me not to sudo. And I definitely capitalize on that principle because it's a lot easier to capitalize on that than to actually give people the nuanced understanding of why you should or shouldn't. But when you run sudo, what it means is that something is going into a system path. So it's not inherently bad. You should sudo apt install. Apt is the prime example of what you should be sudoing, because apt is going to install the correct system version of a tool for your system for whatever dependencies are within that. Right. And when you need to use sudo to install something, a couple of bad things happen. One, if it's not apt or it's not an officially supported tool of your Mac or your Windows doesn't really have sudo, but similar concept applies, or you know, your Linux distro, if it's not an officially supported tool and something is going into a path that can conflict with a system tool, that can lead to unpredictable behavior.
So you're saying, like, I have a system installation of some program and it depends on like the correct Python,
for example.
Yeah, exactly. The correct Python version existing in some place in your system path.
Yeah. So things like on macOS, things like LLVM, Python, Ruby, you don't want to put any of those, if you need the, you know, a newer version, you don't want to put any of those in a path that could possibly be confused at a system level. Because in many systems, user local bin is actually going to be set at the system level, not at the user level. Now, when I say user here, I mean USR, for those that aren't familiar with the, that stands for Unix System Resources. It's kind of the, I don't know how to describe it off the top of my head, but it's where programs install to. User local is things that are installed local to this system, but for all users, you know, and you've seen this in Windows, you know, install for this user, install for all users. I think you see that on Mac as well. Right.
Yeah.
So it's that kind of concept. So when you do the all users install, something can go into the system path. And so sudo is a warning to you that something might go in a place that can cause an undesirable and unpredictable effect on your system. So we're not talking about being malicious. We're just talking about doing the right thing. But, in, you know, the system's going to do what the system's going to do. And there's a mix of convenience and security that, you know, user local bin is one of those places that's the gray area.
Well,
the other problem. Oh, go ahead.
No, I just want to clarify a point. So, like, for example, if I'm doing some development, some like Python development for a web application, the Python version that I need for my project, I kind of think of it as like wholly independent from whatever crap's going on inside my system with Python.
Yes.
And the reason I like what I think is the philosophy behind Webby is it's like, let's treat that as a separate thing. Because
it's per user installs.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, cool.
It installs in the, there is a standard for these things. And unfortunately most people don't learn them. And that's because it's, like, there's no AWS certification for where do developer tools go on a Mac, right? But the standard is .localbin and .localopt of the home folder. And there's reasons that tools that are old tools written in C++ or whatever don't go in those locations, which I can address that in a few minutes if we want to put a pin in that. But the thing that I wanted to wrap up on talking about the permissions was just that when you install something with sudo, the permissions are going to be root. So even if it goes into a correct place where your user should be accessing it, the permissions will be changed to root most of the time, or at least some of the time, or worst of all, sometimes. And what this leads to is the old NPM problem of people can't NPM install a thing. And so then they start sudo NPM installing. And then that has trickle down effects, because then you start to get things that are permissioned as root sprinkled throughout your system. And then you get frustrated and you reinstall your Mac.
we've certainly had that happen with some students. I'm just going to reinstall everything and see what happens.
Yeah. Well, because the trickle down effects, you know, they kind of spread like a virus. You install one tool permissioned and you're like, I don't want to figure out what's wrong. I'm just going to sudo it. And then you do that with it and you do it again and again. And then you start to create inconsistencies in your system where a program running as your user can't access a file that's in your user's home directory. And so as a developer, if you don't have the background of understanding the nuance of sudo, you want to typically avoid it for tools that aren't shipped with your Linux distribution or with your Mac distribution.
That makes a lot of sense. Now for the more important question, why do you pronounce sudo incorrectly?
Oh, you'd forwarded that to me, or put that forward in the document. And I had to think, cause I don't actually know how I pronounce it. But it's super user do, sudo.
Yeah. I remember learning that like 3 years into being a professional developer that it actually stood for something and it wasn't just some nonsense word, super user do. And I still just can't, I just can't do it because it looks like it should be pronounced sudo to me. It's kind of like the GIF thing. I'm a GIF sayer. I'm not a GIF sayer. But
yeah, Jif is obviously wrong, and I think we can all agree on that, and there's no debate or controversy there.
Jif is clearly wrong. Sudo, I don't know. But it's one of those things that I cannot change my mind. Like, if I actively tried to say it the other way, I don't think I could.
Okay, well, so how do you feel about POSIX?
Oh, I don't say it aloud enough to have a hard opinion, but I definitely in my head am saying POSIX.
Yeah, you know why? Because it's all caps and it sounds stronger that way. But Richard Stallman, I kid you not. So he's the one who proposed that it's I'm positive about POSIX. I swear he did it for the psychological effect of making it sound weak because he hated the whole POSIX standard thing.
That's hilarious. It has a vowel. It's like, to me, it's like pronouncing it pseudo. Well, maybe it's not. I don't know. I feel like the I in POSIX should make the O say its name. POSIX. Like, that's how I learned it in elementary school.
No, I agree with you. But by virtue of the fact that POSIX is a standard, I say its name the standard way. But I do feel a little bit. Like I just had my right arm chopped off every time I say it. You know, it's like POSIX.
The most egregious offense while we're on the subject of pronunciation that I've ever heard was my very first job. One of the developers pronounced Nginx Nginx.
Not the first time I've heard that one.
It was awful. It's not only is it clearly not what was intended, but it just sounds so forced. Nginx.
Yeah.
I didn't like that one.
Yeah. That happens.
I didn't like that one. Okay. Anyways, pronunciations aside, call it pseudo, call it sudo, whatever. I want to circle back to this whole idea of permissions.
Yes.
Shell pipes. The way Webby works, my understanding, is that we're downloading a shell script and in the same command, we're piping it and running it through sh, right? Shell
yes.
interpreter. Is that not scary? Is that not dangerous?
Well, so this goes, and this is one of the things that I occasionally battle with the neckbeards, because every neckbeard knows that you're not supposed to pipe to the shell, but no neckbeard knows why. Well, if it's a white neckbeard, they know why, in which case they shouldn't be arguing with me. So this actually dates back to the era of the floppy disk. So I don't know if you were you a child of the early 90s?
I had floppy disks in my home, but by the time I was comfortable with computers, it was CD-ROMs.
Well, there was this concept of shareware. So that before the internet was the sneaker net. And so, you know, in the early viruses came on floppy disks and stuff, and then also there's just kind of this intellectual superiority of knowing that your files are integral. And so we needed to have SHA sum. Well, back then it was MD5 sums or MD4 sums or whatever it was, but you needed to have checksums of a file to know that you truly held the authentic copy of the software as the good author intended. Right.
Right.
And those got to be distributed over the internet. And then as open source started to really take off with the Linux and all that. So now we not only have shareware, but now we have we have stuff that you can download from the internet. But the internet's really expensive and nobody ain't got no money to be letting people download nearly a gigabyte of CD-ROM with all the packages, which because the internet was so slow, you wanted to jam pack all the packages onto that CD, you know, so when you sudo apt-get next time, you could put the CD back in so it could grab the packages. So with all the mirrors, then you also had the checksum. So you could go to the original, you know, Debian site or Red Hat site, and you could see the checksums and you could know that your files are integral. Right?
So you'd get the file. I just want to make sure I'm understanding, because this might be super new to some of my listeners. You'd get the files like from a physical CD, but then you could at least go online and check the hash. Is that what I'm understanding?
Well, and when you would download them, you would download them from a mirror.
Okay.
So universities would mirror the Debian or the Red Hat or whatever. So you'd get the checksums that validated that you got the real file. It wasn't a malicious file. It wasn't altered. And back in those days, we didn't have TLS prominence. So everything was over FTP and HTTP, which you know, just a coffee shop router can modify files on the fly. And that wasn't just a hypothetical, that was real. Like, coffee shop routers actually did, you know, when you hear these commercials about the VPNs and all that, like, that stuff was real back in the 90s. It's not now. Now you don't, now everything's encrypted over HTTPS. But anyway, that's part of it, is that, you know, if you're just downloading random files and piping them to a shell, you're not getting the integrity checks, and you could be installing an unofficial version or something like that. And then also there's if you write a shell script, the way that the shell script works is it executes line by line. So it's a true script. It's not pre-interpreted. And so if you don't wrap your script in a function, then it won't wait to ensure that the entire script is correctly formed before beginning to execute. And when you're looking at dial-up, where the internet connection dies all the time, it is theoretically and practically possible for a partial line to be the last thing that's interpreted before the connection terminates. And so the hypothetical, which I'm sure was real in at least one case, was having an rm-rf/whatever, and the modem dies at exactly the slash, and then your entire drive is deleted.
That's right? Amazing. So I want to say that again, so that people catch exactly what you're saying. When you're piping a script that you've downloaded from the internet, and you're piping it as you're receiving it, like across the wire, it could theoretically read rm-rf, which is delete everything recursively from some file location, and then slash, which is the root of your whole system, right? So it could read that much, and then the kind of connection drops, it executes that, deleting your whole system, when really what the script may have said, if we would have been able to download the whole thing, I mean, like rm-rf, you know, slash user local bin, and then, I don't know, some program.
Right. So those are the technical reasons. And I don't know that anybody really cares about them, but that's, you know, when people bring up their sage wisdom and their, you know, it's again, it gets to be a little bit dogma. We don't have that problem anymore. We have checksumming on the wire. We have encryption on the wire. We have signature on the wire. So all of that stuff, you know, if you're worried about any of those types of concerns, that's basically like saying, well, what if GitHub gets hacked? We're effed.
Right.
Like there is no and then.
At a certain point, you're placing your trust in something. And with Webby, it sounds like, I mean, as long as you trust the webinstall.dev domain name and the SSL certificate that it comes with, that's kind of where the buck stops.
Right. And so that's the other thing, is, you know, trust. Trust is really what it's about. And so in the early days, there was a lot of trolls that would put up scripts in forums that would do nasty things. But this is basically akin to free porn, right? You know, this is how it still works today. Some site offers either a cracked version of a game, a cracked version of expensive software, or naked ladies. And so people go and they install the stuff because they want, it's a Trojan horse, right? So there's the Trojan horse. And in the early days, there were a lot of Trojan horses being delivered through forums and stuff. And so admins would say, don't curl pipe stuff from the forums, because there's a bunch of trolls that are just trying to, you know, mess with you and actually have you delete your computer or whatever. Right. So there was that, and that was probably the real, I don't think that the practical case was that your checksums weren't matching, or that, you know, scripts were being partially downloaded, but it was more that there was a bunch of trolls. And so you have to establish trust. But this is no, what's weird is people say, oh no, you need to download the deb. Don't curl pipe it. Well, if you download the deb from someone who's promising you cracked wares, whether you download the deb and sudo install the deb, or you curl sh the script, it doesn't matter. Like, neither one is more secure or less secure,
right?
Because it's about the authorship of the source. And we see this, you know, like Rust, you curl pipe to install it. brew. You don't technically curl pipe. You curl, I don't know what the technical name of it is, but it's not a pipe. It's similar to a pipe. It's creating a file handle. No, they don't do it with the file handle technique. They do it with the string, the string technique. So they, but there's like three different ways to do it. It's yeah, all I the see same what you're
saying.
Thing.
It's like the dollar sign escaped. Yeah.
But it, and the reason that brew probably doesn't use a pipe is probably because of the whole, you know, don't use pipe. So, well, we don't use a pipe. We use a redirect instead. But the truth of the matter is the pipe is compatible across every shell that I've used. So it's compatible with shell, with POSIX shell, with bash, with fish, with ZSH. I haven't tried it with new shell, but that's on my to-do list. But, it, you know, so essentially people may have some sort of residual resistance to the pipe idea, but it's not grounded in reality of today in 2023 where we use HTTPS, or in the reality of it's webinstall.dev. It's not like some weird random website. The pipe is the thing that works the best across the most environments. So I don't want to obscure it by, you know, using a bracket dollar sign quote rather than just using a pipe when it's literally the same thing. And when using the pipe, it's more compatible across the different shells.
Yeah, just looking at the homebrew installation guide, like it very clearly uses bash, right? It's not /bin/sh, it's /bin/bash.
Yeah, and there's reasons for that. So Webby is a little bit... we have different goals. So brew is going to be installed on a Mac. You're not going to use brew in a Docker container, right? But people use Webby in Docker containers. So we need to be POSIX compliant because the Docker shell is a POSIX shell. It's not bash. And so, Alpine is a POSIX shell, not bash.
I want to call out this distinction for a lot of our listeners that may not be familiar, because frankly, the amount of times where I've needed to make a distinction between am I writing a SH script and a bash script has been like probably less than 10 in my entire career that I can remember. It was like, oh, I'm using a feature of bash. I need to like, and I'm trying to run it in a just a normal SH POSIX shell setting. What's the difference? What's the difference between /bin/sh and /bin/bash?
You know, I think that there's some crossover in the sense that SH may have been standardized modeling after bash. I'm not sure when it was actually standardized, but I don't think it was till I'd have to go look, but the latest standard is 2017, which is actually exactly the same as 2008, but with some ambiguities in the wording cleared up. POSIX shell is a lot simpler. And I think that you will actually understand the shell environment better if you use the POSIX shell. The problem is there are no resources for learning the POSIX shell except for the manual, which is $819 as a PDF or free as HTML.
Is it accurate to say that the POSIX shell is like a subset? Like anything you can do in the POSIX shell, you can do in bash, but... not everything you can do in bash, you can do in the POSIX shell.
Yeah. It is a subset, and there are a few niceties that you don't get in the POSIX shell. The POSIX shell only has one array. It's kind of like JavaScript arguments, you know, where the only thing that uses pointer references in all of JavaScript is arguments. The only thing that can use an array in a POSIX shell is $@, which is the list of arguments. So it is actually quite similar in that regard. There is no other way to do arrays. And I kind of think bash was the first of its kind and the worst of its kind. Maybe it wasn't really quite the first of its kind, the first most popular of its kind. Bash is an absolutely terrible shell. I can't imagine why anyone would use it other than that it's installed by default, because it's not good for scripting and it's not good as a user. And in comparison to your alternatives,
it's better than the default Windows CLI.
That, I mean, I don't.
You gotta give it that, right?
I don't know that that's a valid comparison.
CMD.
Because one, you're so old school, you are not caught up with Windows 11 at all. I can tell just by the way you're talking. You really got to get on the Windows 11 train. You know,
I'm on Windows 11. I just don't dev. Like, the only time I dev on Windows is in Windows Subsystem for Linux 2.
Well, I, yeah, that sure. And we could talk about that too. But I will say this. PowerShell, when I finally really started learning it, because PowerShell is what we use on Windows for Webby.
Yeah.
And the PowerShell is a heck of a lot simpler, because for Mac, Linux, and the BSDs, they're so similar that it doesn't make sense to create a different mechanism for each of them, but they're so different that there's all those little complexities and contradictions that have to be accounted for. That it's like, I almost want to split up the Linuxes and the BSDs, but it would be too hard to maintain all of the stuff that's the same for the, I don't know, couple dozen pinprick paper cuts that are different. But PowerShell is actually really well thought out. It has some paradigms that I don't think that anybody who isn't a functional programmer would be used to. So basically zero IT people will understand PowerShell by default, but PowerShell is really well thought out. Once I finally dug into, because at first I thought, what kind of idiot made this? But then once I learned that my presuppositions were completely wrong, it's not at all like the POSIX shell. It's not trying to be, and it has some distinctions that are so counterintuitive from what we think of in scripting and, you know, scripting languages, actual scripting languages, that it's weird.
So do I need to just like quick answer? Do I need to give development on Windows a chance with PowerShell as opposed to my install WSL immediately approach?
There's I can give you no quick answer to that. Why are you developing locally? Why aren't you using a VM?
WSL 2, I am using it.
What I meant is a VPS. Why aren't you out there in the real world so that while remote, you're developing, you're actually integrating with your single sign-on and you're actually integrating with your web services? That's my counter argument there. But I would say PowerShell, if you are a Windows user, PowerShell has some power to it. It's good. I it has the AJ stamp of approval. If this actually goes public, I will deny that statement.
We're gonna have to cut this out in post.
Yeah.
Nice. Okay. Cool. I might take another look at PowerShell, give another chance. I have zero patience for the default, the CMD terminal.
Well, that's not there in Windows 11.
Oh, it's gone?
Well, I suppose you can still to it, but the thing that opens up is Windows Terminal. Windows Terminal. In Windows 11, Windows Terminal is the default terminal, and PowerShell is the default shell.
Okay, I'll need to take another look. Cool. Another question that comes up a lot, especially like students that I'm pointing towards Webby, is that, you know, Webby has a few hundred tools, and by and large, it is like the most important tools for most web developers, right? You've got things like Node and Go and Python. Do you use Webby in tandem with Brew when developing on a Mac, or do you try to just use Webby?
So two things here. We're going to come back to that pin with the C++ programs. But if I install something twice, the third time I install it from Webby.
Okay. You mean you installed it like the official like .zip or whatever, and then you download it through Brew, and the third time's through Webby?
Typically the tools that I use, I get from GitHub releases or from the author's site, where it's, you know, more a bigger company or foundation like Node. If I know that I'm going to use this tool again and again, I'll immediately get it on Webby, and that'll be the first time I install it. Like I've had that scenario before. If I'm just testing something out because I'm not sure whether or not I'm going to be using it with that was the other thing I didn't talk about, was that I do a lot of client work, and so Webby is my documentation, and you know, part of my deliverable delivery system for clients, because they are hiring a consultant because they don't actually know how to do all the things. And I needed something that was streamlined. That's like, I don't want to explain all the nuance of, you know, how to install Node so you don't have the sudo problem. I want to be able to like give you a couple lines of documentation and this is going to work for you and you're going to feel happy about it. But that was circling back to a previous thought. To answer your question. Yeah. So I will, if I'm going to have it be something that a client is going to need to install, if I'm going to be installing it on my computer again in the future, I will get it up on Webby with a few exceptions. And those exceptions are, the reason that Brew installs to user local by default as a whole operating system installation where there can be conflicts rather than into the home folder .local by default is that a lot of these older programs, most of them, they are hard coded with the path where they will look for their libraries. So there is not a mechanism to have a relative path of when I install this, I install it for AJ or for Lane or for Ryan. It installs for the whole system, or it has to be recompiled specifically with that user's path. And so Brew does have a no conflict install guide. And when you install Brew with Webby, Webby just follows those three instructions. The upshot is that Brew becomes conflict free. It will not install things in system paths. System tools will not accidentally end up getting the Brew version of a library as opposed to the system version of a library. The downside is that it has to spend a whole lot more time compiling because it can't use a lot of the Brew bottles it can't use. Not that it can't use any of them, but a lot of them it can't use because those Brew bottles are hard coded with the user local path. So when you Brew install it, it'll take longer because it's going to compile, but then you get something that's conflict free. And one of the core tenets of Webby, especially working with clients and whatnot, is that we need to produce stuff that's conflict free and guaranteed to work. Not works sometimes, not works on most machines, works 100% of the time. And so,
is one of the downsides to that you can't install system dependencies when you need to? Because, like, for example, occasionally you'll come across a Stack Overflow article because you're trying to figure out why, like, you're trying to run Python and some C dependency is missing. And the answer is like, oh, Brew install this package and now your Python will work because it depends on that missing C library.
This is not a problem because, again, all those paths that are being installed through the local, the conflict-free install of Brew are also being installed in that place. So as you're running as a user, all of your user tools absorb those paths.
So as long as you're using like Python in this example as a user, we should be good to go.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm going to recommend that you install Python through PyInv, and we do a little bit of that automation and, you know, the necessary automation in Webby so that gets installed correctly for you. So the main drawback is just the compile time. And if something goes wrong, it is still possible because there are still tools that you use as a user that when you use them as a user may have some sort of dependency. Typically, I think it would be at the binary level rather than the library level, because if it's a system tool, it's going to be kind of hard coded to only look in the system paths. Whereas if it was installed with Brew, it's going to be looking first in the Brew paths and then in the system paths. You know, if we're talking about the conflict free version that I'm talking about. But it is still possible that something depends on something that's in your local environment that's the wrong version. If that happens, you don't have to reinstall your computer. You can literally just delete the brew folder and then, you know, redo, you know, export what you've installed with brew, cherry pick the things you want to keep. Don't reinstall the thing that screwed stuff up.
I want to pause and kind of re-explain something, or maybe explain it a little deeper than we did before, because I'm just seeing in my mind that we might have some listeners that where this is still a sticking point for them. When we say system and user, are we just talking about the idea that, like, on a single machine or a single, I guess, operating system installation, you can have stuff that's shared by everyone using the machine and stuff that's scoped to individual people using the machine? And when we say system, we kind of mean everyone. And when we say user, we mean like individual user accounts on that machine.
There's one more layer than that. I mean, yes. Yes to that. There is one more layer, which is that there are actual processes that belong to the system that you don't touch directly.
Okay.
So, like, for example, unattended upgrades, you know, when you walk back to your machine and it's rebooted itself, that's not something that you or any of the users on the system generally directly interact with. That's just something that the system runs. And there's lots of things that the system runs. Generally speaking, things that are all the way down at that level, and an errant installation of a library or whatever in brew is not going to, generally not going to affect at that level, because those ones are isolated a level further. So for example, on Mac OS, it's like an entire file system that is the incorruptible read-only base system. And that's why Mac OS updates have gone from being 300 megabytes to being 12 gigabytes every single time, is it'll just replace. It's almost got like a Docker approach where it's a layered
download the
file
new one,
system.
Replace it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Now that makes sense. I wanted to clear that up, because I feel like in modern web development, it can get a little confusing, because a lot of the time you're the only user of your MacBook, right? So it's like this distinction between system and user seems nonsensical. And then when you deploy, you're the only user of the server. So, like, who cares? Whereas I think in a lot of other contexts, you know, like shared hosting and things like that, it would make a little more sense.
I think yes, but there's still another layer to that, because there are lots of things on your system that don't run as the system, but they run as a user that is invoked by the system. So for example, if you have a web server, your web server often runs as the user www-data.
Right.
Or sometimes that user is called HTTP, or sometimes it's just called www. But there is a user on a web server, and by web server, I mean a web server appliance, not a web server like Go or Node. But
like
when people are
Nginx or a Caddy.
Well, I mean of the appliance, meaning the container, the physical hardware, the whatever it is, because we encapsulated so many different layers nowadays. But yes, whether it's the container that hosts Caddy, or it's the physical system that hosts Caddy, or the rack mount switch that's virtualizing Caddy, or I guess router, that, you know, whatever layer you're looking at it as, that container has a may have a user that is specifically for that thing, depending on, you know, if you're going full container, it's just going to be the app user in Docker, or maybe just root. But as you scale back to more traditional, if you get to full Linux box, it's going to be the www user.
Yeah. No, that makes sense. Cool. The next question I had lined up for you that I wanted to make sure I understood. I was reading through on webinstall.dev kind of some of the selling points of Webby. And one is that you only use first party builds. What does that mean?
Oh, so this is pretty simple. And it has its pros and cons. So you don't download stuff from Webby. What you download from Webby is 50 kilobytes of POSIX shell or PowerShell. And that essentially just runs a little bit of dare I say, diagnostic on your system. Like, is this an ARM system? Is it Mac? Is it Linux? Is it x86, 64? Or is it, you know, it just does that few commands. And then is zip installed? Is xz installed? Is tar installed? You know, well, tar's always installed, but you know, it does a few checks, and then it sends that information to the server, because the comparing of that is not something that's easy to do in a shell. And if we were to do it in Node, well, then you'd have to have Node installed in order to use Web, right? So it's kind of that first principles problem. So POSIX shell and PowerShell are on all systems. So it's going to take that information. It's going to send it off to the server. And then the server has a cache of GitHub releases, Node releases, Zig releases, etc., that it downloads from the author. So we don't keep a version other than that it lives in cache.
Usually from GitHub, probably?
Yeah, GitHub. GitHub releases is the most popular. Over half of the tools are hosted through GitHub releases. Yeah. So it's going to find a release that matches the operating system, the CPU architecture. And sometimes that's not the most current version, because some tools won't release their Windows version for until a week later, because they don't have the Windows version automated, and so somebody has to manually go do that and that sort of thing.
Right.
But yeah, so it it sends back the URL, and then your computer downloads that URL directly from the source. So I don't see, well, I mean, I we see what you're downloading because you requested it, but we don't see those bytes. We see the URL, but we don't see the bytes. So your computer downloads Node.js directly from Node.js.org. Your computer downloads Go directly from Golang.org. Your computer downloads ripgrep directly from GitHub releases API.
Right.
So there's no middleman. Now the pro of that is that literally, if it was released within the last 15 minutes, then you can install it with Webby. The downside is that occasionally package maintainers change their package structure. Hmm. You know, this is rare, right? This is like, this happens once or twice a year among the packages that we have. But if they change their package structure, that is something where we currently need a manual verification by a human to say, okay, it's this file that's in this directory and this other file that need to move, or something like that. And I think we can get that to a point of being heuristically done, meaning it just checks to see, is this file executable as a single file, not a directory? Okay. Is there a directory by this name that has a single file in it? You know, like some of that stuff.
Or just send the file tree to ChatGPT, like, you know.
Well, I've considered, I would not do that because it would not be reliable because of the random component.
Yeah.
But I have, you know, I've noodled about that. Like, would that work? Could we get it to work reliably? Heuristic's going to be the way to go. Heuristic's going to be 100% accurate 100% of the time. But yeah, so you get it directly from the source. The downside of that is occasionally when there's a breaking change, like a V1 to V2, or when there is a package structure change, that the install doesn't go as directed. And to give credit where credit is due, when you are using, now everything goes through PR in terms of the installer. You can see the PR for anything, right? That's all open source. But if the author becomes malicious, which we have seen that happen, right? That's happened in the last 2-3 years. That's happened a handful of times now. If the author becomes bitter or malicious and publishes a malignant version, this also means that there is no gatekeeping by Webby like you would have with other systems where, yeah, it might take them 2 or 3 weeks or 2 or 3 months or 2 or 3 years to get the latest version, but you're getting a version that meets all those compatibility guarantees. This, your relationship is direct with the author. If you trust the author, you download the latest version. If you don't trust the author, don't use their tools.
Right. It's very, you can tell it's philosophically web-based. Like, this is a very web developer thing to do, right? Just kind of live on the edge, move fast and break your system. It's like,
well, things working is really, really critically important to me. So I've got a very negative reaction to you saying it that way.
Well, I could say it differently, but it would still work the same way.
But it's not a move fast and break things, right? When you want to get the latest version of Go or the latest version of Node, you don't want to wait 3 months, right?
Yeah, well, I guess the way I'd say it is like, because it's not a guarantee that you'll break things, but when something is broken, it will break. You could still rapidly fix it, right? But well, it feels very like web philosophy to me. Because again, you're installing local tools for local development. So if you do get something that's incompatible, right, you're not going to have to spend all day debugging your system. Like you just try again, probably, right?
Yeah. So, and this is one of the neat things that was an emergent behavior. Is I care a lot about reproducibility. I care a lot about like the guarantee it will work. I want you to have the highest degree of confidence that Webby will work for you, that it is literally the best and most reliable solution you can have. Now, obviously, there have been hiccups. I mean, that happens, right? But that's the goal. The goal is to be, you know, 100% of the time, 100% of the time.
Yeah.
And with that, we are less efficient than a package manager would be because we don't remove old versions. We don't remove the downloads from the downloads folder. When you Webby Node or Webby Go or Webby Nerd Font, it will go and it will download. And you can do the @ too. So you can do Webby Node @LTS or Webby Node @V20 or Webby Node at beta.
Yeah.
And it will grab that version. So you have the specificity that you want. I don't install Node by Webby Node. I always do Webby Node and then the version, at least the major version of Node that I care about, right?
Right.
But if something goes wrong, I have a history of what most recently went right. Because it doesn't delete the old version of Node. That old version of Node is still there. And if you were to do Webby Node @18... it will check the downloads folder. It'll see that it's already downloaded, so it won't download it. Then it will check the folder that it was extracted to. It'll see that it was already extracted, so it won't extract it. Then it will check the symlink to the unversioned node folder. It will see that that is incorrect, and it will replace it. Actually, it doesn't check that it's incorrect. It just replaces it because that's zero cost. So it just replaces the symlink from .local opt node -V20 whatever to .local opt node. And so you can see your previous versions, and at your leisure you can delete the ones that you no longer care about. And this also has the benefit, so you get version switching for free across any tool that you ever install. You have a version history across any tool that you ever install. And this solves some of the problems of NVM. Now, NVM, I think, is more for front-end developers than back-end developers, because front-end developers do have the problem where, like, literally every 6 weeks, React breaks, and they have to have a specific version of Node that did work with it. You know, like,
yeah.
That's a front-end problem. But on the back-end, what you care about more is reliability, and then worrying about like the breaking changes every few weeks. So NVM, one of the things that it does that people like is that when you switch between versions of Node with NVM, I think it kind of happens automatically, like as you go into a project folder. And then also your global installs in NVM are separate from your project installs. So if you have Prettier installed through NPM, when you switch versions of Node, Prettier is still there pinned to that version of Node. But with Webby, because we're not a node-specific tool, this is just something that, you know, whether it's Go, which I don't know why you'd ever need. No, I do know why you need. There have been occasions when you need to switch back a version in Go. Like, there have been, I think.
It is rare. It's extremely rare.
I think there's been three of them in the last, you know, 15 years, but they've happened. Anyway, so what happens is when you switch versions of Node, it's a completely different installation. So you will actually reinstall Prettier. Now, to some people, this is an inconvenience. But at least to myself, I prefer the stability over the inconvenience, because when Prettier released Prettier version 3 and they dropped support for Node 16 or whatever it was just a few weeks ago, well, I can have Prettier version 3 installed for Node 20 and I can have Prettier version 2.9 installed for Node 16.
Yeah.
Because whatever version you switch to, the installs are completely isolated and conflict-free.
This was going to be my next question, because the first time I used Webby, I was doing a little digging and I was like, okay, so it's a shell script that I'll download, I'll run it. Looks like it's grabbing something from GitHub. Fantastic. How is this little shell script going to be smart enough to handle all of my upgrades? How does it know what version I have? How does it know which version I want? So how does it handle upgrades? Obviously, it sounds like you can install individual versions of things. That's fantastic. When you want to upgrade, do you just run the exact same installation script again and it brings you up to the latest version?
Yeah, so in your original title, and I don't know if this is the title that's going out, but you said, you know, Webby, the not a package manager.
Yeah, yeah.
Webby is not a package manager. Upgrading things is not a concern. You know, on your system with apt is going to...
You've defined the problem away. Well, upgrading things is not a concern. I'm like, well, I need to upgrade some stuff, so...
Well, but you run to install what you want. If you don't give it anything, it's going to install at stable, right? So if you just run Webby node, it's going to grab node at stable.
Got it. And when stable updates, though, do I just run the same command again, or do I have to do something a little different?
No, you just, I mean, you can run Webby node at stable every day.
Okay.
The inconvenience that will cause you specifically with node, because node is its own ecosystem with, you know, Node is unique in this way that many, many, many command line tools are actually written in Node.
Yeah.
And so
an unfortunate reality that we live in,
you know, and so if you buy into the Webby philosophy and you believe that the guarantee of version tracking is better than the convenience of, you know, I mean, basically if you prefer the convenience of always having Prettier installed at the version with the global version of Node pinned, NVM is the right tool for you, not Webby. But if you prefer that guarantee over the convenience, and you know, you just have a, like I do, you just have a script in your local bin folder that just reinstalls all your Node tools, then, you know, you Webby node at stable and then you node tools install.
Yeah, yeah.
So, but yeah. And one of the things that we didn't really touch on, Webby is not the tool for the C++ programs of the 1980s that have, you know, six dozen dependencies on libssl and libzip and, you know, lib, you know, what, you know, you see when you sudo apt install, you want to install one thing. And it's like, wait, why is this installing a GNOME audio player for a command line tool? You know, like,
yeah.
That is that's not within the scope of Webby. It's not something Webby's trying to do. Webby is focused on modern daily drivers.
Right.
And so if you want or need to install something that is in that archaic design, and I will qualify that in a moment, it's not the right tool. Brew's the right tool for that.
Okay.
And what I mean by archaic design is we always, as engineers, we're always dealing with trade-offs, and we inherit the trade-offs of the previous generation, even when the conditions are no longer true. So the original design of Linux was perfect for distributing GNU Linux, Debian, Red Hat. It was perfect for distributing over floppy disk. It was optimized and ideal for distributing over floppy disk. We had small hard drives. We distributed things over floppy disk. And you don't take an enterprise system and just switch it to the latest new thing, right?
So
as the internet has become ubiquitous and people have broadband, you know, apt and RPM are not going to update the way that they've done things. They have their entire business structure and the trust of their users built on the way that system works, and to change it would be possibly quite terrible.
Yeah.
But we don't live in a world, I mean, even though we've gone back from having, you know, 2 terabyte hard drives now to having 256 gigabyte hard drives again, even with that, we don't live in a world where we need to conserve 110 kilobytes on a library.
Right.
And we don't live in a world where you need to wait for your distribution to issue a security update to one of your developer tools. We live in a world where you package something together. I mean, Slack is the perfect example of this. I don't think that Slack is a good, it's not the ideal example of this, but it is the real example of this. And I think there's lots of ideal examples. I think the way that Mac does it with the dot app distribution is great. But Slack's like, what, 500 megabytes for a chat app that's, you know, 3 pages of HTML and some CSS?
Right.
And I think that's
the entire browser with it, right. Even though you already had one. Yeah, yeah.
So I think that is inherently bad. That's an example where it's gone too far. But that is what people are willing to accept, and it is better than the alternative at the time that Slack was created. Now we have better alternatives. If Slack was created today, it would be a, you know, 5 megabyte Tori app, or I forget what the competitor to Tori is, but you know, it'd be one of those things. Nowadays, we're not dealing with Internet Explorer 7 or whatever it was when Slack started, right?
Right.
Slack had to ship the browser, but that ideal of, okay, we're not worried about the kilobytes. Because I gave a streaming example that was hundreds of megabytes. That's bad. I mean, that's Docker territory. But when you're dealing with, like, I'd rather have a program that's complete and working than save 200 kilobytes and have to make the round trip. I think about this. You want to download that 200 kilobyte library. Well, first you have to update your package manager. You know, if that's Brew, then, you know, there's 500 megabytes. If it's apt, well, there's 30, you know?
Right.
And then you have to go download the 230 kilobyte file, and it has to run through this whole process. And it's like, okay, so 8 minutes later, I have my updated version of LS, right?
Right.
I mean, that's hyperbole, you know, it's 30 seconds later.
Yeah, yeah.
But these sites, our developer tools, like, come on, just download the whole tool. And that's where most of the tools, well, I don't know if I want to say most, I'd have to double check that, but many of the tools on Webby are written in Go, or Rust, or they're otherwise portable.
Yeah.
So you don't have to worry about updating hundreds of dependencies.
Right. I mean, that's the whole Go philosophy, right? Is, I mean, when you're downloading, Go is by far my favorite programming language for CLI tools. And the two most important reasons to me are it's fairly fast, right? The number two, no dependencies, generally speaking, right? You've got a statically compiled binary. You don't have runtime dependencies like you would have with Python or JavaScript. You don't have like linking dependencies like you might have with a C++ binary. It eliminates a whole class of problems.
It has an Achilles heel, though.
Don't break my heart.
Binary size.
Well, yeah, but like that's the whole discussion we're having right now. It's not so bad with most CLI tools that it's in that sweet spot in my experience.
So I have used TinyGo. I used TinyGo, and I got Pathman down from, and this was I'd already replaced Pathman, but Pathman. I got it down to something like 150 kilobytes from closer to 1.5 megabytes.
Okay.
But this actually was a problem for Webby, because originally there was no way to update the path on Windows. There actually had been a new release of PowerShell at the time that Webby started supporting Windows that supported this, but it wasn't widespread yet in the Windows installations. And more importantly, I didn't know about it because it was bleeding edge. And I was a PowerShell noob. If you wanted to update a path, the character limit, because this goes back to like the Windows 3.1 days, the the tool that edits the path in Windows could only handle up to 255 characters.
For your whole path?
Yes. So in order to deal with that, I had to write a program that I chose to write in Go. And because there's other things like you want to be able to do lexicographical sorting or something like that. You know, there's things that you want to do that are not easy to do. They're easy to do from a programming language. They're not easy to do from a true scripting language. Hmm. And so I wrote Pathman in Go, but a lot of these CLI tools, it's a really interesting ecosystem because it's not just web developers that are using Webby. There's a lot of kind of hardcore Linux people using Webby too. And there's been a little bit of clash of culture there because of Webby is based around the idea that you're not an expert and it needs to work. So for example, it follows the at least once principle. If it does not detect something in your path, it will add it to your path. If it happened to be that you also added it to your path, it's not going to correct that problem.
Right. You'll just have it twice in your path. And which will work, also, it's just a little redundant.
And then also, some of the people were upset because this was the only dependency of Webby was Pathman. And I had to have Pathman because I had to have a way that guaranteed that when you installed it, it was in your path.
Right.
And people were really suspicious of a 1.5 megabyte binary that edited a text file. So there's a little bit of the culture clash there where I agree with you. No, it's not the end of the world. But I, coming from a Linux background, feel embarrassed shipping a Go CLI tool. Like it's honestly a sense of embarrassment for me. And it is my core motivation for getting into Zig is to be able to write CLI tools fluidly, effectively, and at a cost that I won't offend my fellow Linux brethren.
Yeah. Let me be clear. If you can write it in Zig and have it be less, sure. That's fine.
TinyGo is probably going to be about the same, by the way.
Okay.
TinyGo is available on Webby.
But to me, in my world, so I don't work with a lot of hardcore Linux people.
Sure.
Right? I work back-end web development. We're doing a lot of stuff with Docker and Kubernetes. To me, like 1.5 megs is small because I'm comparing it to other things, like depending on the entire Python interpreter. Right?
Or the entire operating system.
Yeah, yeah. So, and the peace of mind that comes with a statically compiled binary. I just want to point out to listeners, like, there is a world in which 1.5 megs is huge.
Yes. Right?
Especially if you're coming from, like, embedded. And so when I say, like, Go binaries are fairly small and efficient, they are in my context of back-end web development. Everything's relative.
No, I 100% agree with you. It's just when I'm working on Webby, there is a cultural divide that I want to meet people with.
Yeah.
Because it's sensitive. This is personal, right? Like take for example the Windows search bar that they just added. Now I get political propaganda on my operating system when I go to look for a program to run. This is an invasion of personal privacy. It feels wrong. And I have a buddy who works in IT and he said that, you know, he just got flooded with people thinking that they had a virus.
You know? Yeah.
It's an invasion of personal privacy. And there is a cultural, a moral boundary that I am trying the best I can to respect because one, I personally belong to that culture. It's where I have my roots. I did not come from a boot camp. I came from IT to scripting to real software development, you know?
Yeah.
And so I don't want sysadmins to be my enemy. I want to be their friend. I want to solve a problem for them. I want them to feel safe and secure and good about what we're doing and not have this backlash of, oh, don't install shell pipes. It's got a 1.5 megabyte Trojan horse. It's going to eat your computer.
Your next talk at the next conference you speak at, I want it to be entitled the moral implications of binary sizes greater than 1 megabyte. Have you considered the ethics of the situation?
That talk, I would go down a different road, and it would be a lot more. I'd end up talking about React.
Oh, man.
Talk about the moral implications.
All right. To wrap up here, I just want to talk about really quickly, where does Webby go from here? What are your plans for 2024? And do you need any help? Do any listeners of this podcast, is there any way in which they can contribute back?
Okay. So again, you've asked two questions or three, and let me tackle the first one. What's 2024 look like? Well, one of the things about Webby that has not been 100% reliable and has been fragile in the sense that fixing one person's bug sometimes causes a bug for someone else has been ARM CPU detection and libc detection.
Okay.
And those have actually crossed over. So ARM is weird for a lot of reasons, stemming from the fact that it's a standard, not a company. The company owns the intellectual property. Other people license the intellectual property. There's a lot of ARM variants, and Linux and BSD and Mac don't report ARM the same way. So they use different string identifiers. Okay. And there's also an ARM64 system on Linux can run ARMv7 binaries, not an ARM system on Mac or Windows, but an ARM system on Mac or Windows can run x86-64 binaries. So that, and then the libc system, meaning Go has no libc. It's none, it's static. Right. Most muscle builds out of Rust and Zig, et cetera, or just Zig by itself, are static. But then there are some builds that actually require muscle libc++ or something else, require a GNU dependency.
Okay.
And so one of the most important changes that's either, well, probably will launch this next week, and we've already done the first part of it, is going through all 33,000 release assets and guaranteeing 100% that not a single one is either classified correctly or excluded. And that is done, but that's not deployed because it needs other changes. And then also guaranteeing that 100% across Mac, Linux, Windows, and BSD, we always correctly detect the CPU architecture, which that hasn't really been the problem as much as making sure that the waterfall of Mac, the Mac one has been solved. It's the Linux one that's been the problem. That the waterfall of figuring out what binary is compatible if the preferred binary isn't available. So you don't have an ARMv7 binary, but you have an ARMv7 CPU. What should we try to give you? Or you have an ARM64 CPU on Linux, but there's no Linux ARM64 build. Which ARM binary should we give you? So it's a niche problem, but it's a problem that people really have. And it's a problem that the best effort holding it in my head logic has caused three problems over the last 2 years of someone having to report that when I fixed a problem for one person, it broke something for someone else between ARM and muscle builds. So the analysis is complete. There's a little bit of matching logic left. We're going to launch with that. And that is a crowning achievement to be able to say, I know with 100% accuracy that there is no edge case of particularly an ARM system or a muscle system that will get the wrong binary.
Very cool.
And
it'll work the same way for me, it sounds like, but still very cool.
Yeah. You won't notice a difference. You know, 99% of people won't notice a difference, but it's kind of that at least pedantic and probably not pathological, because I think that there's something to be said about having something work not 99.9% of the time, not 69% of the time, but 100% of the time, that gives us all warm fuzzies.
Yeah, we like that. We like that.
So that's I think the biggest thing that's coming up. We've also added colors to the output. And mostly I'm doing the work. It's the other people that are involved are more on the review or like minor change here and there, but there are some regular contributors there, but I'm doing the heavy lifting on most of the stuff. And that landed, but it's not uniform. There's still a bunch of strings that need to be updated to be indented properly and have the little color function called on the string in the shell script, by the way.
This isn't like what is it, bubble tea, like install a package in your Go binary. This is you're coloring it in the POSIX shell, right?
ANSI escape sequences, but I found a way that I think is the right trade-off of looking absolutely wretched and but I like it.
Cool.
Being a little bit more explicit is coming up. There have been people that have been surprised the way that we edit the path. And so I think this is mostly landed. I think there's a few more changes, but making sure, trying to find the right balance between verbosity, giving so much information that people just their eyes roll and it feels like a more complex process than it is. And then being really explicit so that people always feel safe, that you're not surprised that your Bash RC was edited to source a path file that's machine readable.
Too much text is the same as no text in a lot of cases. Getting logging right can be tricky.
But we'll find that balance. And then as far as, you know, contributions, there are some things that I would love. So I am not a people person. I tend to piss people off. I don't really like the social media. So if somebody really likes Webby, you know, what we're doing, you know, if you buy into the philosophy of it and you like it, and you're one of those people that is more comfortable on Reddit, Hacker News, Product Hunt, stuff like that, I would love it if you just post on there and, you know, take the hate from the trolls that have something to say about, you know, why don't you just use the PKG install? And because they don't want to know. You tell them it's a permissions issue, they're gonna, you can't argue with the people, you can't satisfy them. But, you know, anyway, but the PR of it, we're now at 1.1k stars. We are solid.
Yes. Go star it if you haven't yet, right? Webinstall.dev. There's links to the GitHub there. Go star the GitHub.
Yeah. And then if you actually use a weird OS, and I'm not using that term derogatory, I'm kind of using it tongue in cheek, but some of them I think actually are weird. Like Plan 9, no one's actually using Plan 9. Please let me know if I'm wrong. There's not a single developer out there that is using Plan 9 as their system. Well, because I look at these release assets and I see all these operating systems like, okay, well, if the release asset's there, then we should support it, right? We're not supporting Plan 9. I'm sorry. That one's out. Namely because it doesn't ship with the uname binary. I downloaded the latest version of Plan 9 over the weekend. It doesn't have uname. I'm not learning a new operating system that literally only the people that use Plan 9 are not the people that are using Webby or Brew or doing web development.
So if you're using an esoteric operating system that's not Plan 9, please get in contact with AJ.
Yeah, AIX, Dragonfly. I think Dragonfly is on the mainstream of the weird ones. I'm not sure. Maybe it's not. OpenBSD, FreeBSD, NetBSD. Especially I'd love help testing the ARM matching on those. I had a whole list of them that I put on Twitter, but there's like 10 operating systems, or I think closer to 15, that we have release assets for. And I just want to know, is anybody actually using those operating systems? And if you are, and you like, if you really find value in Webby, I will make it work 100% of the time for you. If you are a single person on a weird operating system, I will make it work 100% of the time of you, unless it's Plan 9, or I think that you're trolling me.
Fair enough.
Which, like, you've got to be trolling me to say that you're using Plan 9. But and then just stuff like I'm not really social. I'm not really great at the community. I mean, I'm social in the sense that I love to talk, but I'm not necessarily the best listener or community
podcasts
builder.
Podcasts are a great format for you. Yeah.
Yeah. I've got ears for podcasts. But design work, if anybody wants to do some vanilla CSS work, I'd love to get the site redone and a little more modern feel, but, no frameworks, no, Like there's things that we have Tailwind, on there that I'm ashamed of and I want to get rid of. Tailwind might work out because I think that ends up just being CSS.
I'm a Tailwind advocate. Yeah, I'm a fan.
So I'm not sure. I'm on the fence about Tailwind. But yeah, and then there's like tedious tasks. There's stuff like we need to move the file section in every single cheat sheet. That's the other thing we didn't talk about was the cheat sheets. That's like the other 60% of Webby. Well, we talked about it a little bit. I said Webby is my documentation for people.
Give us the 30-second how do you find cheat sheets.
Oh, you just go to webinstall.dev and then whatever the thing is. You know, webinstall.dev/node, webinstall.dev/caddy. We probably have the best caddy cheat sheet on the internet, just saying.
Oh, cool. Okay.
It's not the best looking, but it's got the most complete information for like the 10 most common use cases you're going to encounter. So helping with cheat sheets, like adding stuff to cheat sheets, and that's kind of the, what would we not put on Webby? Mm-hmm. If it's not good enough to write a cheat sheet for, it probably isn't good enough to be on Webby. Like if you're dispassionate about it, that you can't take 30 minutes to write a thoughtful cheat sheet for it. You're going to have to try harder to get me convinced that it belongs there. But yeah, there's a few tedious tasks like that where it's, you know, you could get some open source contribs.
Okay.
And you know, grammar changes, whatever, that kind of stuff. And then, I mean, as far as the core of it, I think there's not many people out there that are experts in the POSIX shell or in PowerShell. I don't know that I'm an expert in PowerShell, but I think I'm in the top 1% of people that use PowerShell at this point. And I'm certainly within the top 1% of people that use the POSIX shell, as long as we're including people that use Bash.
Very cool. Well, it sounds great. Everyone who's listening, webinstall.dev, if you're interested, that's the name of the site. You can find the GitHub repos there. Where can people find you specifically if they want to follow you or get in touch?
They don't want to follow me or get in touch.
There's nowhere to find AJ.
No. So if you want my spicy takes, CoolAJ86, that originally was cool as in chill before I became an angry, grumpy guy that yells at clouds. And
that's
then
at CoolAJ86 on Twitter, right?
X. Yes.
That's the one. Yep.
We don't speak the, and then underscore beyond code is the code bootcamp that I'm not actually running, but does have my best tweets in terms of good content that is non-controversial, or at least if it's controversial, you're definitely not the problem, not me. And very then, cool. And then Webby has its own Twitter as well, okay. Which I have to actually look that up. I think it's underscore web install. Cause you know, people just, every name is taken.
It's sounding like the best place is if you're confused about where to go, webinstall.dev, CoolAJ86 on Twitter.
Yeah.
Cool.
Sure.
Awesome. Thanks so much for coming on, AJ. This has been awesome. We'll be using webinstall.dev or Webby, at BootDev all year. And I'll let you know if we have any issues.
Yeah, seriously, if there is any problem, it is a bug. It should 100% the only acceptable goal.
I love that. I love it. Cool. I'll talk to you later, man. Have a good one.
All right. Adios.